welcome everyone back to another episode of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and we're on the New Books Network. And today I'm excited to bring you a book that I actually have sent, or I'm going to send to my mother as soon as we're done talking about it today, as she is an educator herself. And this book is 50 Myths and Lies That Threaten America's Public Schools, The Real Crisis in Education. And this is by David Berliner, and Jean Glass. In this book,
and our associates,
there's plenty of associates. We cannot list them all in the podcast for brevity, but please check the blog post, and we will have a link to all of the associates for that. And I think you heard that right there. That is Dr. David Berliner. And David, let me just go ahead and read your sort of opening quote that you have. And I think this is really nice because someone close to me, as I mentioned, my mother, who is an educator as well, and you guys kind of dedicated this to educators who were connected to the family. So let me read that. It's really nice. To our nation's teachers, often underpaid and underappreciated, expected to reach unattainable goals with inadequate tools, who still have managed to make our public schools the path to self-fulfillment for generations of Americans. And you dedicate this to the educators in the family. So I think that's really, really great, really nice sentiment. So getting right in, jumping off from that point, why did you guys decide to write this book, and why is it important, and how did it sort of come together?
We were, Jean Glass and I were moaning and groaning for years over what we considered stupid laws. For example, No Child Left Behind would have 100% of the kids proficient in this year, 2014. Well, that's a patently stupid law. No politicians sign on and say 100% of the kids will be proficient, above average. It sounds like, you know, Lake Wobegon, and it's kind of bizarre. So then we have other things like the law that's going around the country to flunk kids if they're not reading well. And things our legislature would say, and we would commiserate with each other and talk about it. And we kept saying we need to write a book, and we didn't get to it. And then we thought of what Al Franken had done, which is that when he needed to write a book and needed his facts to be accurate, he went to Harvard, hired us 7 or 9 students, and asked them to be his fact checker and to co-write with him. So we decided to co-write with some of our students. We have some of the brightest students in the world at the University of Colorado Boulder and at Arizona State University. So those are our 19 associates. And so we said, look, there's a lot of misinformation out there. Let's try to write about it in relatively short chapters. Let's write for school board members and parents, and let's keep the research graphs and regression equations to a minimum, maybe leave them out altogether, but talk about what the evidence says and see if we can start 1,000 conversations.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's one of the things that I do notice about the book is that while it presents sort of an academic-type argument, and definitely the foundation, it's really written for someone who maybe doesn't really understand advanced statistical equations or has never studied these kinds of things, but it's laying it out in a very nice way that is understandable.
Good. Thank you. That was our goal.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I think it worked for sure. And that's another thing. The chapters are quite small and broken up and very easy, and you can sort of go in and sort of look at the different myths or lies that have been presented in maybe popular discourse and sort of break them down in a very easy manner to understand. One of the things I do also like about this book is right from the beginning, you don't pull any punches with sort of talking about the people who might be helping to spread these myths and lies. And for instance, you talk about Michelle Rhee, who was formerly in Washington, D.C., in those schools. And then, of course, I'm here in New York City, so a guy who's very notable here, Mayor Bloomberg, for his education policies. So can you talk about maybe just quickly those types of people who are spreading these ideals and why you feel like it's important to sort of counter them?
Well, people need to know that powerful people, influential people in education have probably lied. Joel Klein was your chancellor in New York, and it looks like he fudged some data. Bloomberg was his boss, and they must have been part of it. Michelle Reed got a memo that people were fudging scores in her district, and she can't remember it. Well, I don't know about you, but it sounds like lying to me. The Goldwater Institute says early childhood education is a scam. Well, you're in New York City at the Horace Mann School. Some really stupid people then are paying $40,000 a year for preschool for their kids. Why would they do that? So people are saying things that are not true. Bill Gates, he may be a very nice man, certainly in medical work, he's doing wondrous things, but he really doesn't know education. And so he says the costs are up and the scores are down. Well, he's wrong. The costs are up, but it's mostly for special ed and transportation and testing. The cost for my Microsoft programs are up too, but he doesn't mention that. And then when he says the scores are flat, actually is what he said, that's not true. The NAEP scores have actually gone up, and particularly for black kids, they've gone up rather dramatically. So, you know, if I had $45 billion, I think I would get a fact checker.
Fantastic. I think your sort of last point there, talking about some of the tests. Let's kind of dive into the first myth that you guys put out there in the book, talking about these international testing scores that have gained so much popularity in the past couple of years, and really since Reagan's era of a nation at risk. But right now we're talking about the PISA and the TIMSS. And can you tell the audience what these tests are and sort of how they're presented to us?
Okay, there are three major international tests we usually participate in. One is the PIRLS, which is the reading test. One is the TIMSS, which is math and science. And the third, which is the most popular in the presses of the world, is the PISA test, the international program for student assessment. And they get a lot of publicity when they come out because the report is always on the average score, the mean score. The average score contains kids who are in schools where very few kids are in poverty and kids who are in schools with lots of kids in poverty. Put them together, and the United States doesn't seem to be doing well. So the inference that is often made is that our schools are not doing well. But that's the mean score. There are no tall Americans. Why? Because the mean score is about 5'10". Well, we know there are tall Americans. We know there are short Americans. But the mean score is going to hide the variation. That's exactly what happens on PISA. So when you break down PISA, when you break down TIMSS, when you break down PIRLS into five groups, schools where under 10% of the kids are in poverty, schools where under 25% of the kids are in poverty, schools where under 50%, 75%, and then 75% or more in poverty, you have the five groups. It turns out that the two groups where poverty is very low, 10% or less, 25% to 10%. In those two groups, those kids score among the highest in the world in all three tests. And in the reading test, they score the highest in the world. On the TIMSS test, math and science, where we often don't do well on average because we include the kids in high poverty schools, but on TIMSS, the two groups of American students in public schools, about 15 million students, in the schools where under 10% are in poverty, or in schools where 10 to 25% are in poverty, those kids scored higher than Finland. Mm. Now, Finland has always told us they're the best nation in the world. Well, their mean score is high. That's true. It's a much more homogeneous society, and they produce the mean score that's quite enviable. We don't have that because we're not as homogeneous a society. We have kids going to schools where over 75% of the kids are in poverty. We have black kids, poor kids, Hispanic kids, American Indian kids going to school with others of their race and often their social class. And if poor kids go to school with poor kids and rich kids go to school with rich kids, they learn the norms of their peer groups, and one group ends up going to college and doing well, and one group doesn't. This is true of every test that we have out there. Our two groups of kids in schools that are doing that do not have a lot of poverty are among the highest scoring in the world. Now, notice there's a side issue here that's very important, Ryan, to think about. We were just sold the Common Core of state standards because, in part, we have an inadequate curriculum and are not doing well in the international test. That is patently false. Now, the Common Core state standards may be better. That's a separate issue, okay? I don't want to get into that. But when you say that it shows that the American curriculum was inadequate, that's a lie. It's perfectly adequate in the schools that are serving kids where poverty is low. Let me give you an example around this. Asian American kids outscored kids in Japan and statistically, I think, tied with Korea. Now, Korea and Japan are always, we're always told how wonderful they are, but our Asians kick the butts of their Asians. Now, how do you do that in bad schools? You can't. That means the curriculum was working and that the cultures of families, the cultures of neighborhoods are very powerful forces in the outcomes we get. You put a whole bunch of poor kids together with other poor kids and we're going to get low mean achievement test scores. And that's what happens. Put them all together, the United States scores about average. Disaggregate, and we see that our public schools do really, really well when we have public schools that are serving kids with under 50% of the families in poverty. Mm.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about East Asia, especially Korea, I lived there for a couple of years. I taught there for...
That's why I mentioned Korea, and you also know what test hell is like for Korean kids and for other Asian kids. And the question I always keep asking in America is do you understand that we invented childhood about 150 years ago? Okay? Yes. Before that, kids worked in their parents' shop, the shoemaker's shop. Girls helped their mothers in the kitchen. On the farm, they were taking care of animals. We didn't have childhood. And then we invented childhood. And we liked childhood. Childhood is a wonderful period of life, of nurturance and giving and growing. And now we have kindergarten kids being tested so they're career and college ready. We're destroying childhood. And the Asians have always done that. I mean, there's no messing around. You're going to study, you're going to go to school in Korea, then you're going to go to after school, then you're going to go home and do your homework. And they don't date as much, they don't do as much stuff in after school, as far as I know, in some of the Asian countries. It seems to me that the better question for the United States is not whether we want our children to work harder. The question is whether our 25-year-olds and our 35-year-olds are sufficiently creative and well-trained to take leadership roles in business and industry. And the answer to that seems a remarkable yes. Entrepreneurship and creativity works, and we have it for our 25-year-olds. That's where it counts.
Right, right. And as you mentioned, sort of the quote-unquote testing hell that happens over there, I definitely saw that on a daily basis and just felt so much for the kids that were sitting in class from 8 a.m. until maybe 10 at night, things like that. There was actually a law that was passed in South Korea where these special study rooms after school had to close at a certain time because they were being sort of forced to go study so late. And sometimes they would get caught having these kids here till 3 in the morning or some things like that. Trying to make them not study as much. So, it is interesting as well, because when I was there, people would ask sort of like what we did in America and what were our schools like. And when Obama went over there, when I was there as well, and he mentioned, we're trying to get our schools like your schools. And they were like, what? We know something's wrong with our education. Why are you guys telling us everything is okay? You're trying to be like you guys. So I thought that was an interesting corollary.
I think if you want to raise a Chinese or a Korean child in America, you can do so. The Tiger Mom book tells us how to do that. And those kids do well in school. There's no doubt about it. But we have a different vision of childhood. And the only question is whether we're hampered by that vision when people are 25 years old. Mm. Mm-hmm. And the answer seems to be no.
Right, right. Well, let's get back to the childhood then. So you also wrote one of the chapters here talking about early childhood education. And some people have said that this doesn't work, it doesn't matter, we don't need these kinds of programs. And you dispute this. What is sort of, do you want to explain sort of the argument and then how you sort of debunk that?
Well, the many conservatives don't want to spend any money on early childhood education, so they're fighting Obama's plan for universalizing it. But in fact, Obama's on very good grounds for doing so. One typical study done in Europe using the PISA data, they looked back on kids who had preschool and kids who did not have preschool in a whole bunch of countries. And the kids who had preschool, once you control for social class, because of course it's usually wealthier kids who seem to be so stupid, according to the Goldwater Institute, the wealthier parents are sending their kids to preschool and wasting their money, evidently. But it turns out that if you had preschool, you had an advantage, I think it was 50 points, on the PISA test. And it was rather dramatic for low-income kids. In Sweden and England, they did case studies, and in both countries, low-income kids who had preschool scored about 9, 10 points over their peers who didn't, and high-income kids who had preschool scored about 4 or 5 points over kids who did not, who were also high-income. So it looks like preschool works for both low-income and high-income kids, but it works a lot better for low-income kids, better meaning that ultimately they score better on tests like PISA. We have data in our own country that's very suggestive of cost benefits for preschool. I should say something else, Brian. When I'm talking preschool, I'm not talking sitting with Auntie Mame or something, you know. I'm talking about a high-quality preschool with teachers trained in early childhood education, okay? So it's not just daycare. I'm talking about high-quality preschools. We have some evidence that if a community were to invest in a high-quality preschool, the return to the community might be $7, $8, or $9 for every dollar invested, but it won't be returned for 25 or 30 years.
Right.
So it's a long-term investment, but it's a very good investment. You're not going to get that kind of rate of return on many investments. But the number of kids who need special ed goes down if they've had preschool. Mm. The number of kids who are incarcerated later in life is down. The number of kids who have decent paying jobs so that they can pay taxes off of their earnings goes up if they've had preschool. So when you start factoring in all the long-term effects of what preschool has been found in at least 3 or 4 programs that were high quality and studied very well, you find that it's one of the most cost-effective investments any community can make.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we don't have it, and it's being fought when Obama's trying to offer it. There's also a side that maybe needs to be talked about a little about the kind of a moral issue here. And lots of parents, particularly single parents, are working. They need some place that is high quality for their kids while they're working. If we don't take them out of the labor force and keep them in the labor force, single parents, single women particularly, their children might very well suffer, and we shall see that when they start school. But if they're in a high-quality daycare preschool, they're going to learn some seriation, they're going to learn their colors, they're going to do a little language work. It doesn't have to be a very academic preschool, but it always does some of that. They show up in kindergarten and first grade a lot better able to learn. They've had books read to them. They've had food given to them. These are going to be healthier mentally and physically kids that enter our public schools. And for so many single women on very reduced incomes, working at the Walmarts who don't pay and the Targets that don't pay, we need high-quality daycare. So it's a moral issue as well as an educational issue, I think, if we want to keep these women in the workforce.
So if we have the data and we sort of have the moral reasons, then what's the argument that's coming from the other side saying that this doesn't work? Is there bad research, or is it simply just the nature of not wanting to spend money from the government, or are they looking at private interest into this? What's sort of the arguments coming from there that way?
I think there are probably many, but I think of two. One is the remarkable anti-tax notions that run through this country. We just had a meeting of the six or so candidates for governor in Arizona on the Republican side, and three of them swore to reduce our taxes and get rid of the personal taxes. Well, how do you run a society without taxes? I'm sorry. Those are stupid ideas. They're not, and you can't do that. So part of it is this anti-tax notion that runs through the whole country. I don't want to pay for anything else. In fact, I want to divest myself of everything. And you see that in the charter school movement and the voucher movement, in which we are asking people to divest themselves of the taxable schools. Our chief state school officer in Arizona made 15,000 robocalls telling people to leave their public schools and go get vouchers. So what we're seeing is all over the country, the anti-tax force is trying to divest themselves of one of the largest budget items in every state, county, and local budget system, which is their public schools. I think this is irresponsible for lots of reasons, among which we will never be able to keep our democracy if we lose our public schools. Mm. But there's a second reason that's even worse. It's just plain mean. And that is, I want secure positions for my kids, and the hell with yours. What you're seeing is the job market is changing radically. The number of really good paying jobs is being restricted. They're just not there like they once were. So who's going to get those jobs? The best educated people, the Stanfords, the Harvards, the ASUs, which is a fine public university. The people coming out of there with the best educations are going to get those jobs. And the more I can keep black kids, brown kids, poor kids, Indian kids, other kids from competing for those very good jobs, the more likely my child, my boy or my girl, is going to get one of those good jobs. So I don't want to support them. Now, that, I think, is mean, but there are people who have expressed that. They want the opportunities for their kids, and they'll pay for that because then they know that their kids will be taken care of. That's just plain... it's self-interest at its meanest.
Right. Occam's razor, getting into the self-interest type way of thinking. You mentioned, I know you didn't write specifically about it in this book, but you mentioned charters and vouchers. So I'm wondering if we could just briefly discuss those for a second. Can you maybe just, because I know some of our audience might not be as familiar, especially when we're talking about the U.S. domestic policies. If you could just mention sort of what a charter school is and how is it different than our normal public school, and maybe how is it different than a private school, if you can, and then sort of what a voucher system is as well, if you don't mind.
Okay, well, the charter schools were an idea that seemed innocuous enough at the time. If some teachers or some entrepreneurs thought they could run a better school, let's give them a charter to do so. There'll be good competition for the school. Competition is good in the marketplace. All that seemed reasonable. So charters were long history to it, but they became popular some years ago. Mm-hmm. Arizona, my state, is one of the leaders in chartering and was one of the early chartering states. Basically, a district could allow a teacher group to open a school, and it would be part of the district, funded with public monies. But it also allowed entrepreneurs to open a public school and get public money. So if you're giving $8,000 a child to the public school, and I open a charter school, that is, I appeal to the state for a charter, and I get it, I open a school, I get a facility, I open a school, I get 100 kids, I get $8,000 for each of the kids, so I'm making a lot of money coming in, and then I need to actually run the school. So how do I run it? I run it with teachers who I pay less. I run it with computers doing some of the teaching. I run it with I make the parents do the education, do the transportation, etc. And then I can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So with 100 kits and $8,000 a kit, you can do the math. There's a lot of money in there. If I only pull out $100,000 from my salary, that would be wonderful. And then if I buy services from my brother-in-law or sister-in-law to clean the school, to provide the lunches, then the family gets to keep another $100,000. Mm. And this has been happening all over the country, scam after scam, because the market people who wanted the charters, because they wanted the competition, don't want any regulation of the charters. Mm. So what they want is public money used for unregulated schools. And it's very hard to get regulations for these schools, except fire codes and things like that. But other than that, they say, well, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let's see how the charters do. But we have very good evidence that the charters are not any better than the public schools. Many are worse. Few are better. But most of the better, quotes on better charters, are due to pretty sneaky stuff. Mm. Like, anyone's allowed in the charter, but I'll counsel you out if you're special ed. I'll counsel you out if you're an English language learner. I'll fail you out and tell you to go back to a public school if your parent doesn't sign a contract saying they'll help you with homework, etc. So the charters have been a disappointment. They have not produced the kind of hot new ideas in education that right. they were supposed to. In fact, when you think about it, you know, schools have been around roughly 3,000-4,000 years. It's hard to invent a better way to educate than we have already, you know. I mean, we could start putting iPads in, but that's just the iPad substituting for an instructor in a way. Mm-hmm. So the charter idea is not paid off, and there's lots of skimming and creaming of students, and that's very harmful and very misleading for the public. So one charter here says 98% of our graduates went on to college. Well, what they don't tell you is that they had 120 kids in fifth grade and 20 when the kids graduated.
Right.
Well, any public school that picks out its 20 best graduates will have a record equal to that charter. Mm-hmm. But we don't. We try to educate them all.
Right.
So the charters have been a big disappointment. Now, the voucher plan is a very sneaky system of getting money to schools that are public money. The voucher legislation, it varies by states, but the voucher legislation is likely to be something like, if you send your kid to a private school, then obviously we're not paying that money for the public school, so we'll give it to you. So even if your private school costs $20,000 a year, as many do, we'll give you the $7,000 or some piece of it, maybe $5,000, to send your kid to a private school. Well, who's going to do that? All the rich people who can afford the $15,000 bridge between what the state will give them and what the cost of the private school.
Okay, yeah, fantastic. If you can maybe get into, because I know we have to sort of jump back into some of the things that you wrote for the book, and I really am excited about the charter stuff. So if you're interested in that, for the audience, go in and read the book, and you can get more of that. So David, if you want to get back to, I know one of the sections that you're sort of passionate about yourself is this idea that I think connects a little bit to the charter school, sort of moving the kids along, which I thought was very telling in the book, where they would sort of just tell these kids to leave or go somewhere else. There wasn't really the buy-in in the entire kids. They're only sort of investing in maybe the top-level kids, and that's why they're getting these standout rates. But if you could kind of talk about in the public school, talking about leaving kids behind and sort of the rationale that is talked about and that this is good for the students, I guess is the myth that is posed in the book. And if you can talk about why sort of that is wrong and what's the benefit of moving kids along or making sure that they're actually where they're at.
One thing about the charters and the voucher plans, these are both ways to use public money in unregulated ways. We are giving license to people who may or may not be honest brokers. And we have lots of evidence that many of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's important here. On the issue of this program that's, I think, in about a dozen states right now, Florida, Arizona among them. This is, in Florida, it's called Florida Reads or something like that. In Arizona, it's called Move On When Reading. And in third grade, we essentially say, well, if the kid's not reading by third grade, they're going to have trouble, which is true. So let's leave them back, which is probably an absolutely stupid choice to make. We have so many research studies that tell us that for the kids that we're going to leave back, very few of them will be advantaged by being left back, and the vast majority of them will be hurt by being left back. How are they hurt? They dislike school. They drop out sooner. Their parents change their opinions of their own kids. It's heartbreaking. When you do interviews with kids who have been left back, you find out that they say it's the equivalent of going blind or losing a parent. It's so, so harsh. The important thing, though, is that the evidence is quite overwhelming that leaving a kid back is harmful to the kid. If you had identical twins who were not doing well in third grade, and you left one back and moved one ahead, the one who was moved ahead with their age mates would like school better and be scoring higher on standardized tests. That's the evidence. So why would anyone then not pay attention to the evidence and be willing to spend $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 more for a child to be kept in school another year? And the answer is meanness, cruelty. There is no justification for leaving a third grade kid back in the research literature. Now, I suggested to some Arizona legislators that if you're going to spend an extra, let's say, $8,000 because you've committed to leaving a kid back for the year, why don't you spend $4,000 a year for 2 years to get a tutor for the kid? Tutoring is a very powerful form of instruction and could help the child read. I have in my family a third grader who the teacher said was not reading at grade level, so the family invested in tutoring. At the end of the year, the kid was reading at third grade level and was advanced. It's not very difficult to do. It's not any cost differential to do. And we have legislators who want to give, quote, the gift of time to children. Well, it's not a gift children really need. It's not a gift families really want. We'd be much better off investing in tutoring for these kids and helping them be ready for fourth grade or fifth grade or what they need.
Right, right. And how does that affect, especially maybe an ESL learner, with their trying to catch up into learning English as a second language and maybe even a third language potentially?
Yeah, again, if we regard our English language learners as somehow deficient because they're not reading English at the rates we want, we just need a change in our understanding. These kids are not deficient. They are, in fact, have assets. They have another language. Mm-hmm. And they're mastering English as rapidly as they can. I know of no kid who doesn't want to master English as rapidly as they can. And what we need to do is have some maybe after-school programs, some summer programs, do some parent training. Bilingual education works when it's, again, the issue is high quality, like early childhood. Just shoving a kid in an immersion situation and say that's bilingual education is not very helpful. But true bilingual education and even better dual language schools work very well. America should have dual language schools instead of canceling out the Spanish that kids bring or the Chinese or Korean that a kid brings. If we had dual language schools, then English speakers would learn Korean or Spanish and the Korean or Spanish kids would learn English. The dual-language schools are asset-based. Most bilingual programs have some sort of belief that there's a deficit somewhere. That's nonsense. The people who speak two languages actually have cognitive powers beyond monolinguals. They seem more creative with language, and they actually deteriorate less slowly they deteriorate less rapidly when they're older because they have two stores of language. So, if you want to know what's good for a nation and good for a child, it would be trying to raise bi and trilingual kids. And instead, what we do is try to squelch the language that an immigrant kid brings. It's really stupid.
Right. And sometimes you get these calls that, you know, English isn't, or if they're not learning English, it's somehow un-American, or learning another language is somehow un-American. And you do actually hear people and even politicians saying these kinds of things, which it sounds like you would agree is a little bit ridiculous, or a lot ridiculous.
Ridiculous is a kind word. It's stupid. I mean, the evidence is that this is a stupid belief system. It's actually to your advantage to know two languages or more. So if you want intelligent Americans, try to preserve languages as you're teaching English, not try to squelch them. So the paranoia is always there when people speak another language. You're almost sure they're talking about you. So there's kind of inherent paranoia, and we got to get over it, because chances are they're not talking about you. Mm-hmm. And so, and the politicians who say it's un-American, I mean, are the Dutch un-Dutch? Every Dutch person speaks English, okay? In fact, they'd rather speak English. Dutch is a hard language to speak in the rest of the world. The Danes speak English. The Norwegians speak English. Are they unpatriotic? Do they not love their countries? So this is a statement that's based on some sort of paranoia, and it has to be gotten past.
Right, right. And I hear all these arguments and these myths that are coming out, and I guess I have to ask, it does seem that, you know, on all the myths, there is somewhat of a right slant or more conservative slant. Was the idea in this book to sort of be calling out that political wave, or did that just manifest by itself as it was sort of going along and you kept finding these myths?
That's a very good question, Ryan. I haven't confronted it before or thought about it. I think it was less political. I think it turned out that way. A lot of these beliefs that we fight against are promoted, the anti-tax legislation, the anti-childhood stuff, the leaving back. I think a lot of that is conservative, and so we look like we're anti-conservative. But I would say most of our authors are progressive, most educators are. I know we had a few who I would call certainly middle of the road, maybe even a little right of center, but I would call all our educators pretty progressive. And again, it's hard to be an educator and not be progressive.
Right.
Because, I mean, you're believing in the future. You're believing in change, okay? Mm. And you're believing that government, schools, can be effective in making that change. A lot of conservatives think that when the government is involved, it's necessarily evil. Mm-hmm. Well, very few educators hold that view. So my guess is we were more progressive than we were liberal or leftist.
Right. And I wasn't suggesting that's actually in the book, but as we start kind of talking about it and laying it out in this conversation, it just kind of dawned on me that this is sort of, it ends up being a theme throughout the book that maybe wasn't really meant to be there, but just sort of comes out.
But again, so you know, we tried the chapter on Teach for America. Mm-hmm. We asked a local leader of Teach for America to write that chapter. He was a doctoral student in our program, and we said, look, you know it best. Give us a fair chapter, pros and cons. Mm-hmm. And he did, and I think it was a very fair chapter. We all edited and worked on it so that it was as non-biased as could be, written from a real friend of Teach for America.
Right.
The chapter came out and they fired him.
Oh, wow.
So, just so you know.
I see. Okay. Well, I guess to do him justice, can you talk about what that chapter says a little bit? Or what does it say? What did he find for Teach for America?
Well, I mean, he makes a wonderful point I had not really thought much about before the chapter, which is that he thinks that a lot of Teach for America teachers are replacing or replacing teachers who themselves would show a lot of turnover and who are not the best in the field, or they wouldn't have that kind of placement in the lowest income schools. Now, I don't know if he's right or not, but he said, you know, that's part of the reason he thinks that many Teach for America teachers trained at very fine institutions like my own, Arizona State University, mm-hmm. or Harvard or Stanford, he thinks that having them in for 2 years may not be all that bad. But what he admits and documents quite clearly is what their first 2 years are like. They're hell. Mm. They're untrained teachers who cannot get the assignments across. Now, they learn fast. They're smart. They're committed. Some of my finest doctoral students at ASU have been ex-Teach for America teachers who say, oh, my gosh, this is a fascinating profession. I'd like to get into it and work in it. But the majority of them in their first year are failures, the vast majority.
Right.
And many of them, as you know, get out in 2 years, most in 3 years. And so you're not getting the buildup of skills that we know it takes to be a really good teacher. It takes 3 to 5 years to gain the kind of expertise you hope teachers would have in school. So I think he wrote a very balanced chapter on Teach for America, showing its warts, talking about where it makes contributions and why it's important, and they fired him.
Wow, that's give him my regards. I'm glad it. I'm glad
give him his job.
Well, I think it adds to this book considerably, especially because Teach for America, I think, has become somewhat of a cultural, at least out of the mainstream and into the main, out of education, at least, for sure. Just jumping back on a couple of these.
Just so you know, having Teach for America teachers is a wonderful thing for keeping the budgets low, because we know they're going to churn and they're going to not stay in the field. So you can keep hiring new teachers and not pay for experienced teachers.
Right.
So in a way, salaries are reduced by having a temporary core of teachers.
Right.
And that's not healthy for a field either.
Young and cheap labor,
young and cheap,
basically. Well, I guess, can you just talk a little bit, because we're already sort of getting into it, some of the myths that are perpetuated about teachers and sort of their life and their pay in the United States, and you know, are they important or are they not important? Can you talk about just maybe a couple of those? I know they weren't your chapters, but you're certainly...
The salary issue is very important. The U.S. Salary structure was hurt in the recent recession and continues. Teachers are not making back some of that money. But the things about starting salaries for teachers vis-a-vis others of their education level, graduates of good schools in the humanities, let's say, salaries are a little low. More important, the salaries at the top are very low.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get to make the kind of money over time that you would hope a professional person with lots of responsibility in our society would make. In a nation state like Singapore, if you stay, I think it's 10 years, you automatically get a bonus that might be $10,000. I mean, you're a valuable person,
right,
because you have acquired experience. So we're going to give you a bonus to make sure you don't leave. If you stay another few years, we'll give you another big fat bonus.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to stay because we value what you know. In our country, we try to get rid of these people because they cost too much.
Right.
So and what they cost is really not a lot.
Right.
So we have a problem in salaries. Also lately, they've cut benefits. They've cut the retirement plans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the simple notion we talked about before, that there are people in this country who don't want to pay taxes. They want to destroy the public schools and put that burden on private funding.
Right.
This is a destruction of democracy. I mean, Jefferson wrote about this. You can't have a free people without a good education system. That's pretty well known. On the salary issue, I think we have lots of problems. On the tenure issue, today the judge in California ruled that tenure has to be abolished in California the way we know it. Tenure is simply about due process. That's all it is. It's a guarantee to teachers that if the principal's brother-in-law wants a job, they won't throw you out and give it to the brother-in-law.
Mm.
It's about due process. It's about saying that if you are doing your job right in your classroom, the principal can't tell you you have to promote this candidate or you have to promote this policy, that you can say no and not get fired because due process would have you keep your job.
Right.
To do away with tenure which has been a tradition of due process, is to make the teaching profession much closer to at-will teaching. And at-will is very difficult. You're not tenured. You haven't got the stability, and you also don't have the commitment.
Well, it might be easier for someone just to say, you know what, I don't want to do this, I'm going to leave, just all of a sudden.
And you might leave in the middle of a semester, and et cetera, because you can't trust that the institution will provide for you.
Right.
I think it's a terrible decision that was just made, and it's based on some very bad logic by the judge, I think, and I hope it's contested. The plaintiffs in the case claim that poor kids are getting grossly ineffective teachers. And I've been in lots of schools, and to see grossly ineffective teachers is very hard to find. Mm-hmm. You see some teachers you might not like for your own kid, but that's a separate issue from grossly ineffective. In tenure, we have very few grossly ineffective teachers for a couple of very important reasons. And one of them is, in a teacher education program like our own at ASU, we've been known to get rid of at least 10% of the teachers in training. Then if they go into the field in the first 5 years, 50% of them leave because they find out it's not for them, or it doesn't pay well enough, or they can't guarantee the future.
Right.
So what we're talking about is a field that actually polices itself very well and self-selects out. Mm-hmm. At the end of those 5 years, we have a teacher corps that's pretty darn good. So grossly ineffective teachers, I mean, they may vary. Well, they do vary in their competence and their abilities. But the term used in California was grossly ineffective. And you rarely see a grossly ineffective teacher.
Right, right. Well, that was great on the teacher issue. And again, there's a lot more in the book on teachers that we can't get to today. And if you're interested in that in the audience, then I encourage you to go check that out. David, we're coming to the end of the interview. Do you have any last words that you want to say that maybe you didn't get out on the book before we reach sort of the conclusion?
Well, what we wanted to do, and most important to us, is to start conversations. We wrote this, as you noted, for school board members, parents, others in the general population who all have opinions about education, but we think some of them are wrong. But we want to start conversations. So here's 50 conversations to start. Should we have school uniform? That's a conversation. The data on that is quite equivocal. Should we have a longer school day? Well, what would it do for us? Mm-hmm. That's a conversation. We address those in the book. We may not be right on all 50 of the positions we took, but we sure think we have. We can start a conversation and can represent the position, and that's really our goal. There's a lot of stuff that is believed that isn't true or can't be backed up. And sometimes it's just out of meanness, like leaving kids back. And everything we know says that's the wrong solution for the community. So we hope the conversation starts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this does it very nicely with some evidence if someone's interested in these issues, certainly. Kind of our last little question that we like to ask here, David. What's next for you? What's on the research plate? What are you looking into? What interests you?
Well, I'm very interested in what I call the teacher effectiveness paradox. The paradox is everybody's trying to judge teacher effectiveness through test scores, these value-added models, when teachers don't have much influence on those. Turns out that that's more influenced by the peer group one goes to school with, the cohort you're with, the neighborhood you're in. What teachers do is influence individual children dramatically. Now, there are exceptions to what I say, but in general, teachers touch eternity through the students they work with, and their effects on the test scores are much more modest. But we're holding them accountable for the test scores, and we have no way of evaluating their impact on individual kids except through anecdotes and stories,
right,
which we accept in lots of other fields, but we will not accept as data in education.
Right.
So I'm trying to sort that out.
I see. Well, good luck there, and we look forward to that. I'm sure it will be an interesting article or maybe book even, and we'll look for that in the future. David, I do appreciate it, and just for everybody on the New Books Network, this 50 Myths and Lies That Threaten America's Public School, the Real Crisis in Education. David Berliner, Gene Glass, and Associates. Go check it out, and I hope you guys learned something.
Thank you very much, Ryan.